Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A heads up to listeners. This podcast features harsh language and some descriptions of torture. We feel it's important history to hear, but it can also be disturbing. Looking back, the U.S. government panicked after 9/11. There's almost no other way to describe the sheer top-to-bottom alarm and fear that drove its decision-making. Matt Waxman worked in the White House. He served on the staff of the National Security Council.
The sense within the White House, within the government after 9/11, that another big attack was probably coming, and that it might involve weapons of mass destruction, especially a biological or radiological weapon. This fear was very real. Some people accuse the Bush administration of overhyping the threat. I think at some times, though, it probably understated the fears and threats that were being discussed internally and felt in a very real way.
The night of September 11th was a surreal one in New York City. Emergency responders were now joined by hundreds of volunteers at Ground Zero. They sifted through what remained of the Twin Towers.
There are survivors trapped in that rubble. Mayor Giuliani confirmed it less than an hour ago. How many, we do not know.
But only now, hours later, under the harsh lights of rescue vehicles, is the true horrifying breadth of the terror becoming clear.
But what they're doing is they're crawling through the craters and crevices of what's left.
FBI Special Agent Mary Galligan was in Oklahoma City, where she had watched the towers fall on television.
It was the day that evil came to most people's lives. They didn't think it existed, and it came, and it existed, and it was in our backyard.
She had helped lead the New York field office's investigation of Al-Qaeda and its bombing of the USS Cole. And now she was worried about her colleagues in New York, blocks away from the World Trade Center. She was worried, too, about friends like John O'Neill, who had just left the Bureau to become the World Trade Center's security chief. Then the phone rang. Galligan's boss wanted her back in New York. She was going to help lead the FBI's investigation into the attacks. Soon, Galligan was aboard an Air Force flight headed to New York City. She sat alongside pallets of blood being rushed to the attack site for potential survivors. Years later, at a 9/11 memorial, Galligan recounted that day.
Arrived at an Air Force base in New Jersey around 7 o'clock at night, and two agents picked me up and drove me to Ground Zero. I think the first thing that struck me, because like many people, I had seen it on TV and you're trying to comprehend it, is coming up the Jersey Turnpike, I-95, signs, you know, the signs that tell you there's traffic ahead or there's an accident, were flashing, New York City is closed, New York City is closed. Just as someone who grew up on Long Island, went to school Fordham in the Bronx, like New York City is not closed. And so that started the magnitude. And then when I got to Ground Zero, it was still relatively dark. You saw, you know, National Guard trucks starting to come in. There had been some spotlights put up by the NYPD and the fire department. The fire is going on. It's believed at that point that 25,000 people had perished. There were all kinds of reports of other attacks that were coming. And I started to think, how do you start to organize this?
The FBI's New York field office had lost two people in the attacks. Former counterterror chief John O'Neill and a bomb tech special agent Lenny Hatton. They had both died helping evacuate the towers. The New York office was now full of agents desperate to track down the terrorists, but their building had been damaged itself from the crashes at the nearby Twin Towers. So Galligan, a group of other field agents and support staff, all relocated to a nearby parking garage on the West Side Highway.
A command center where there were about 300 to 400 people a shift working in what was a garage. The phone lines, you can see they're hanging down from the ceiling. There was about four phones at the garage at the time. The FBI, as we sometimes do, borrowed the other 296 from different numbers in New York City.
It didn't take long for the government to realize who was behind the attacks. In fact, as soon as officials began reading the flight manifests, they had a sinking feeling. They recognized the names of the hijackers. The men were Al-Qaeda. They'd purchased tickets under their actual names, and the U.S. government had never noticed.
Now, the other thing that was very obvious in the beginning is, were there other attacks coming? So, literally, the manifests of every flight that day were collected and were investigated by the 56 field offices around the country.
The Bureau pieced together much of the terror plot within a few hours, and those flight manifests led to one of the most consequential puzzles of 9/11. Because investigators immediately noticed a specific pattern. American Airlines Flight 11 that hit the North Tower of the World Trade Center, it had five hijackers aboard. United Airlines Flight 175 that hit the South Tower, five hijackers. American Airlines Flight 77, the plane that hit the Pentagon, five hijackers again. United Airlines Flight 93, though, was different. It was the only plane that didn't reach its target that day after passengers and crew attacked the hijackers in the cockpit. As best anyone could determine, that flight only had four hijackers aboard. Was there another hijacker out there? Someone who was supposed to have been aboard the plane and didn't make it? Was there someone ready to lead a second wave of attacks? The hunt for that man, the so-called 20th hijacker, would turn into one of the most important and twisting quests for the government after 9/11. And it would turn into one of the darkest chapters of the U.S. government's response to those attacks. I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and the author of The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. And I've spent much of the last two decades studying and reporting on September 11th and how it changed our world. But as we face the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't know the full story. From Long Lead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. Episode 6, The Relentless Search for the 20th Hijacker and How It May Have Eliminated Any Chance for the U.S. to Find Justice. Investigators raced in the minutes and hours after the attack to identify other Al-Qaeda operatives in the U.S., while officials in Minnesota had a sudden, worrisome realization. They might have already arrested him. The search actually started almost a month before 9/11 with a man named Zacharias Moussaoui. In August 2001, at the urging of the FBI, immigration agents in Minneapolis arrested the French citizen.
Instructors at the Pan Am flight school said they called the FBI on August 17th after Moussaoui showed up offering cash and asking for lessons on a 747 flight simulator. He reportedly was not interested in takeoffs and landings, only how to fly the plane in a horizontal position.
They got Moussaoui on an immigration violation, but the FBI suspected he was actually a terrorist in training. He was in custody and not answering their questions. Just a month before 9/11, the FBI still didn't know how, where, or when, but they assumed Moussaoui was plotting an attack against the United States. Then investigators argued over whether they could get a warrant to search his laptop. The FBI wanted to search his belongings, but they didn't bother getting a warrant. They didn't think they could due to that Chinese wall you heard about in last week's episode that limited the interaction between the intelligence side and the law enforcement side. Jamie Gorelick looked at Moussaoui's case as a member of the 9/11 Commission.
His computer was sitting there. If that computer had been searched, it would have revealed the plot, or a good bit of it. And when the prosecutors and agents in Minnesota, where Moussaoui was being held, tried to get authority to search that computer, they were basically told this is too hard. And no real effort was made to help those agents get that information, which they were entirely entitled to, entirely. When you look back on it, it is astoundingly awful that those communications did not occur, because had they occurred, had the people in the room talking to each other spoken to each other about what they knew, we would have stopped the plot.
So the Bureau came up with another plan. They would deport Moussaoui back to France. The FBI hoped that investigators there could search his belongings for evidence when he arrived. On the morning of September 11th, that plan was still being finalized. Only later that day, while rescuers still put out fires in New York, Virginia, and Pennsylvania, did the FBI finally get that search warrant. They found, among other items, a cockpit operating manual, two 747 training videos, spiral notebooks with handwritten notes on aviation, and a Microsoft Flight Simulator book. Later in December 2001, Zacharias Moussaoui was formally indicted on 6 terror charges. Federal prosecutors began to publicly talk about him as the 20th hijacker. Jackie McGuire was working on the investigation and would later become one of the FBI's lead agents on the 9/11 case. She was on the team that indicted Moussaoui.
And we were working with prosecutors from Virginia. And part, as I understood it, part of that decision to indict Moussaoui in the Eastern District of Virginia was because it was known as the Rocket Docket. They move cases, you know, through appropriately and quickly. What we found with Moussaoui was that it was not quite the Rocket Docket, because there were so many different issues that arose.
The pretrial started out on a tense note when Moussaoui refused to enter a plea. Over a nearly hour-long rant, Moussaoui told the judge he was ditching his legal team and planned on defending himself. Later on, he told jurors, "I am Al-Qaeda. They do not represent me. They are Americans." The government's case against Moussaoui relied largely on similarities between his behavior and that of the hijackers. They took aviation classes, purchased knives, and had flight manuals for commercial jets. So to prove that he had nothing to do with the attacks, Moussaoui wanted to call other Al-Qaeda detainees to the stand. Only they could testify that he had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks, Moussaoui argued. But the Pentagon and the U.S. government wouldn't let that happen. They said it could jeopardize national security. Meanwhile, family members of the 9/11 victims sat in the courtroom, stunned. They watched Moussaoui's case awkwardly stumble from hearing to hearing, never seeming to approach justice. Here's Rosemary Dillard, who lost her husband Eddie on American Airlines Flight 77, the plane that hit the Pentagon. Dillard spoke to reporters after the judge knocked down another request from prosecutors.
"I felt like my heart had been ripped out. I felt like my husband had been killed again. I felt like the government has let me down one more time."
Then, in 2004, just days before voters picked George W. Bush or John Kerry, Osama bin Laden released a video, and for the first time, Al-Qaeda publicly claimed responsibility for 9/11.
"And he said that neither Kerry nor Bush is the answer to security for American people. He appears, as the person did yesterday, to be speaking or trying to speak directly to Americans."
After being postponed, Moussaoui's criminal trial was convened the following year in 2005. While his court case slowly progressed, Moussaoui's mother, Aisha El-Wafi, a French citizen, made frequent pleas in the press. She said her son was a misguided terrorist, but not the 20th hijacker. "They are going to try him for 9/11, she said. "This has nothing to do with 9/11 because he was in prison. He acknowledges that he is an Islamist. He acknowledges that he belongs to Al-Qaeda. But I don't think he deserves death nor life in prison." But then, out of the blue, and shocking everyone in the court, Moussaoui admitted to working with Al-Qaeda to crash a plane into the White House. The jury was left still with a decision. Should he get the death penalty?
"In the case of United States versus Zacharias Moussaoui, as to count one, conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism transcending national boundaries, and count three, conspiracy to destroy aircraft, and count four, conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction. The jury has found the defendant should be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of release.
Mr. Massawi got a fair trial. The jury convicted him to life in prison, where he'll spend the rest of his life. In so doing, they spared his life, which is something that he evidently wasn't willing to do for innocent American citizens.
Zacharias Moussaoui is currently in the federal supermax prison in Florence, Colorado, not far from his fellow inmate, Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing.
Supermax is the place that America sends the prisoners it wants to punish the most, a place former warden Robert Hood describes as a clean version of hell.
Despite his apparent confession, we're still largely unsure about Zacharias Moussaoui's full role with al-Qaeda. According to the tale eventually pieced together by the FBI, Moussaoui had no role in September 11th. He and another al-Qaeda plotter told investigators that instead, he would have been part of a planned second wave of attacks. Attacks that never materialized. So Zacharias Moussaoui seemed like he was not the 20th hijacker after all. Here's FBI Special Agent and 9/11 investigator Jackie McGuire.
I wouldn't call him the 20th hijacker. I would call him co-conspirator, someone who's aware of the plot. I've never liked the term 20th hijacker because there were more. You know, there was not any one person. Sure, Moussaoui had made it into this country. He had attended flight training. If not for some, you know, good investigation and his arrest in August, he could have likely been part of the plot. But there were others. There were others, again, of for varying reasons who didn't make it as far.
This is where the story gets interesting. Because while the U.S. prosecuted Moussaoui, we had another suspect, another man who it appeared could have been the 20th hijacker. But we need to take a step back here. A decade ago, I wrote a book examining the FBI and the U.S. government's response to 9/11. I was stunned at the time about how the systems that normally are used to sift good intelligence from bad broke down. After the attacks, the FBI and CIA arrived in the Oval Office every day and essentially vomited out to the president every uncorroborated lead, tip, or theory they had collected in the previous 24 hours. It was all placed into a spreadsheet called the Threat Matrix, that document full of undigested intelligence, more rumors than facts, was a daily reminder of the worst-case scenarios if U.S. officials made the wrong choice. I ended up choosing that name, the Threat Matrix, as the title of my book on the FBI and the years after 9/11, because it was so key to understanding the nation's fear and why the U.S. government panicked. At the same time, the U.S. turned its back on the successful model we had used to fight terrorism in the years before 9/11. Before September 11th, the U.S. treated terrorism as a crime. The Bureau investigated, indicted, arrested, and questioned terrorists and al-Qaeda operatives. And it worked well. The FBI had developed good cooperation from some of them. And just weeks before 9/11, federal prosecutors successfully convicted the top plotters of the 98 embassy bombings in a New York City courtroom. But now, after 9/11, Vice President Dick Cheney, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, and Justice Department lawyers like John Yoo decided this was war, and the U.S. should treat terrorists not as criminals, but as enemy combatants. People not entitled to all the niceties of the U.S. legal system. That fall, as Cheney and Rumsfeld threw the terror playbook out the window, special forces, CIA officers, and eventually a large-scale U.S. military force plunged into Afghanistan in October 2001. In December of that year, as the indictment against Zacharias Moussaoui was announced, U.S. armed forces were in a desperate firefight. They had surrounded al-Qaeda in the mountains of Tora Bora, where bin Laden had holed up. And that fall and winter, the U.S. military scooped up hundreds of detainees from Afghanistan. They were unsure who was a hardened terrorist, a low-level fighter, or a random farmer in the wrong place at the wrong time. Those captured detainees were loaded onto planes and helicopters and flown halfway around the world, taken to the U.S. Navy base in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The prison at Gitmo was established in early 2002 by President Bush and Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld. It was part of the bleakest chapter of our post-9/11 response. Shane Cotadal is a senior attorney with the Guantanamo Litigation Project at the Center for Constitutional Rights. He's on a team that's traveled to the facility for years to defend the clients being held there.
Folks typically got processed in Afghanistan and Pakistan by the U.S. and then shipped off to Guantanamo, 8,000 miles away. And, you know, I think people understand that that process produces a lot of false positives. You know, there are a lot of people who shouldn't be arrested who are. I think what they don't understand is the pressure that that process produces on the interrogation process, right? The idea that you are taking people 8,000 miles away from where they were captured and handing them off to a bunch of 20-something novice interrogators and saying, you know, well, if they're telling you all that they don't know anything about 9/11 and bin Laden, you're not squeezing hard enough. When you have an enormous amount of chaff, you know, to go with a kernel or two of wheat, it produces all the perfect incentives for the abuses that we saw.
The suspected terrorists wouldn't be arrested and sent through our justice system as every previous terrorist and al-Qaeda operative, including Zacharias Moussaoui, had been for decades. Instead, they were prisoners of the global war on terror, held without access to due process, U.S. courts, or habeas corpus. At its peak, the camp at Gitmo would house almost 700 prisoners, all swept up overseas, transported directly to Guantanamo Bay. There, the U.S. government argued it could hold them indefinitely without charges. Here's Matt Waxman, a member of the Bush administration. Years later, he would tell a congressional committee that the facility at Guantanamo Bay should close.
Some of us in the Bush administration did believe that while criminal law enforcement wasn't enough to deal with al-Qaeda detainees, Guantanamo wasn't a good long-term solution either. We wanted to explore some alternatives. I don't think there was an appetite for that at the top of the administration.
It took months, years really, for the U.S. government to sort through the prisoners it held at Gitmo. And it wasn't until the summer of 2002 that the FBI got around to fingerprinting an anonymous detainee known as 063. His low number an indication of how early he'd arrived at Guantanamo. As far as the interrogators knew, detainee 063 had maintained his innocence. According to the story he told his captors, he was just in Afghanistan looking for falcons. But when the FBI ran his fingerprints, it turned out the man had a name that was familiar to them. A month before the attacks on August 4th, 2001, immigration officer Jose Melendez Perez was at his desk in the arrivals hall of Orlando International Airport, checking the passengers on a flight from London. A young Saudi man named Mohammed Al-Qahtani appeared at his desk seeking entry to the United States. Here's Jose later testifying before the 9/11 Commission.
Subject documents appear to be genuine. A search of the subject and his personal belongings were also negative. Subject was enrolled in IDEN and photographed. In addition, a complete set of fingerprints was taken on form FD-249. Through my INS training and military experience, my first impression of the subject was that he was a young male, well-groomed, with short hair, trim mustache, black long sleeve shirt, black trousers, and black shoes. He was about 5'6" and in impeccable shape, with large shoulders and thin waist. He had a military appearance. I had the impression of the subject that he had knowledge of interview techniques and had military training.
Under questioning, Al-Qahtani raised eyebrows. He had around $4,000 in cash, but didn't appear to have any real plans in the country, a return ticket or a hotel reservation.
The subject became visibly upset and in an arrogant and threatening manner, which included pointing his finger at my face, stated that he did not know where he was going when he departed the United States. What first came to mind at this point was the subject was a hitman. My wife said that I was watching too much movies. The subject was very hostile throughout the entire interview that took approximately 1.5 hours. Our father explained to the AAPD that when the subject looked at me, I felt bone chilly cold effect. The bottom line, he gave me the chills.
In the end, after talking to his superiors, Agent Jose Melendez Perez suspected Al-Qahtani was what immigration officials called mala fide. Basically, he didn't have a good reason for coming to the United States. Al-Qahtani was rejected entry and sent back to Europe. But the story got even more intriguing when the FBI began to assemble more pieces. Someone at the same Orlando airport that day had telephoned a known Al-Qaeda number in Europe. Then, when agents pulled the surveillance videos from the airport parking lots, they found the ringleader of the hijackers, Mohammed Atta, sitting in a car, seemingly waiting for someone. The puzzle began to come together. Atta had been there to collect the man stopped at customs, Mohammed Al-Qahtani. Then the would-be operative was held up by immigration. When Al-Qahtani never emerged, Atta called back to Al-Qaeda HQ to double-check if he had made the original flight. Mohammed Al-Qahtani, it seemed, was the 20th hijacker of 9/11. With the new connections and information gleaned from their post-9/11 investigations, the FBI wanted to interrogate Al-Qahtani in Gitmo. But the Defense Department had other ideas. They were under tons of pressure to prevent a so-called second wave of attacks. And many in the U.S. government were frustrated by the slow progress interrogators were making with other Al-Qaeda detainees. So that summer, over the objections of the FBI, the military and CIA officers at Gitmo secretly began a program known as Enhanced Interrogations. This system was kept secret from the U.S. public at the time, but strongly embraced by the Bush administration. They said it was the only method to secure intelligence from the most dangerous men in the world. They argued that Gitmo detainees were so set on killing Americans that they couldn't be treated as normal criminal defendants. Here's Don Rumsfeld speaking to reporters in 2005.
And what's taking place down there is responsible, it's humane, it's legal, it's proper, it's consistent with the Geneva Conventions, and after a period, that will sink in. Let there be no doubt.
As the public learned of these techniques beginning in 2005, virtually everyone else would come to a different conclusion. In the years ahead, these techniques would simply be called torture. And the first man to be tortured was our new suspected 20th hijacker, Mohammed Al-Qahtani, detainee 063. Attorney Shane Cotadal later read his interrogation log that was published by Time magazine.
You know, sleep deprivation, interrogating someone 20 hours a day, pouring water over their head, making them wear women's underwear, making them dance with interrogators, sexually humiliating them. You know, all the kind of things that we're familiar with from, you know, later on the CIA's detention program in black sites, right? But the very first of the special interrogation plans, the very first torture plan concocted in Washington, D.C., was concocted for Mohammed Al-Qahtani. It purports to show that over the course of about 60 days, these techniques, when applied, you know, slowly drive the detainee being interrogated insane, right? He starts to, you know, quote unquote, break down. The end of the story in the log is that his heart rate starts to slow down into the 20s and he's whisked off to the emergency room down at Guantanamo and they have to stop the special interrogation program, essentially because it's so brutal that it's almost driving him to the point of physical death, right? But this is kind of a test case in some respect, right? The very first special interrogation plan successfully results in breaking someone down psychologically, although there's no indication in the log that they actually get any information that they're seeking out of this all.
While he was in U.S. custody, Al-Qahtani was also placed in so-called stress positions. They included being forced to stand on his feet to deny him sleep. Defense Secretary Don Rumsfeld signed off on a memo approving these tactics. Next to his signature, Secretary Rumsfeld, who died in July 2021, even left a handwritten note. "I stand for 8 to 10 hours a day," he said. "Why is standing limited to just 4 hours?" Al-Qahtani was so abused by military personnel that he had to be administered IVs and enemas to keep his body functioning. Then, in 2004, the Defense Department announced that Mohammed Al-Qahtani, seemingly admitted to his crimes. He apparently told interrogators he trained at Al-Qaeda camps, met with Osama bin Laden several times, and Qahtani said that he'd been sent to the U.S. by Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, one of the 9/11 masterminds, apparently to hijack a plane on September 11th. By then, the Bush administration launched an effort to bring the so-called worst of the worst to trial, but they still wouldn't see a civilian courtroom. Instead, they'd be prosecuted under so-called military commissions, last used in the U.S. to try Nazi saboteurs in World War II. In 2006, Congress passed the Military Commissions Act, giving this new trial system a green light.
This bill will allow the Central Intelligence Agency to continue its program for questioning key terrorist leaders and operatives like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the man believed to be the mastermind of the September the 11th, 2001 attacks on our country. This program has been one of the most successful intelligence efforts in American history. The Military Commissions Act will also allow us to prosecute captured terrorists for war crimes through a full and fair trial.
Despite the Bush administration's argument that the detainees at Gitmo were beyond the reach of U.S. law, the prisoners and civil liberties attorneys had eventually won the right to legal representation. Shane Katadal was horrified by Al-Qahtani's treatment, and his team had taken on the case in 2008. At first, many didn't know why the attempts to prosecute Al-Qahtani kept falling apart. Then, in 2009, we were given a clear reason why.
Courtesy of Susan Crawford, the convening authority for the U.S. Military Commissions, she decides which cases go to the Military Commissions and which do not. Today, Crawford revealed to Bob Woodward at the Washington Post that the U.S. cannot prosecute Saudi prisoner Mohammed Al-Qahtani, an alleged 9/11 plotter, because, quote, we tortured Qahtani. His treatment met the legal definition of torture, and that's why I did not refer the case for prosecution. It was abusive and uncalled for and coercive, clearly coercive.
So Mohammed Al-Qahtani had been left to languish, uncharged in Gitmo, where he remains to this day. As his attorneys like Shane Katadal dug deeper into their client's past, they found a very different picture of Mohammed Al-Qahtani. They found his life before Al-Qaeda was derailed by undiagnosed schizophrenia that was worsened by a childhood head injury stemming from a car accident. At one point, long before 9/11, Saudi police had even pulled Al-Qahtani from a dumpster naked. Al-Qahtani's attorney, Shane Katadal, again.
In order to think that there was something kind of culpable that he should be held accountable for, you'd have to believe that the plotters of this very secret, this covert conspiracy that they managed to hide from our intelligence agencies until it all happened, that the plotters were willing to bring in someone who had shown no ability to control his own behavior, who was manifesting schizophrenic symptoms all the time. And to me, you know, whatever else we think about the folks who planned and carried out 9/11, you know, they weren't buffoons, you know, they pulled it off. You know, I just have the hardest time believing that anyone competently planning a covert conspiracy would bring someone schizophrenic into the fray in any regard, right? Whether it was, you know, unknowingly or not, it just seems like too grave a risk.
If Al-Qahtani was supposed to have any real role in the 9/11 attacks, he probably wasn't the mythic 20th hijacker. As his case wound its way through Gitmo, FBI investigators found that they had probably been asking the wrong question all along. It wasn't that there was a specific plan for a 20th hijacker. Instead, Al-Qaeda had tried to enlist a whole host of other hijackers. A 20th, yes, but also probably a 21st, a 22nd, maybe a 23rd, a 24th. Al-Qaeda had simply wanted as many boots on the ground as it could get in the United States ahead of the plot. And on the morning of September 11th, it found it had 19. In fact, Jackie McGuire and her FBI colleagues had even been able to identify some of these other would-be hijackers, men who dropped out of the plot even earlier. They found one of the hijackers from Flight 93 had even listed another Saudi friend who he hoped to travel to the U.S. with. The two men had applied for visas together in April 2000, but the friend's mom had stopped him from participating in the plot. Meanwhile, the torture programs at Guantanamo Bay left a stain on any attempt to prosecute the facility's remaining detainees. It took years for the U.S. government to sort out the mess it had created in Cuba. Over the past 12 years, the number of detainees there has dropped as those who have been deemed no longer a threat or innocent all along have been released. Now, 20 years later, the camp at Guantanamo Bay is still in limbo. It continues to house increasingly geriatric al-Qaeda prisoners that the U.S. doesn't know what to do with. Since it took over in January, the Biden administration has transferred just a single prisoner. Now, there are 39 left. That includes Mohammed al-Qahtani, the only enemy combatant who the U.S. has admitted to torturing. In February 2021, his defense team reported that the now middle-aged Saudi citizen has repeatedly tried to commit suicide. The attempts have been driven by his now diagnosed schizophrenia, plus PTSD from his abuse by U.S. captors.
The other difficult thing is that having been detained for so long under such terrible conditions, the voices in the last 3 years or so are finally starting to tell him that he should hurt himself, which is a completely new thing. You know, he, I think, realizes this stage that this is happening, that there's kind of another set of voices within his head that are telling him to do things that are harmful to himself, and he's kind of terrified of it. But, you know, it's the natural progression that you would expect for someone who isn't given treatment for a serious psychiatric disorder for a good 14 years worth of his detention.
As the 20th anniversary of 9/11 now arrives, none of the al-Qaeda operatives, including the plot's mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, have faced trial yet. Instead, the U.S.'s bungling of their treatment and the dark decisions of the Bush administration, made in fear in the weeks after 9/11, have robbed the victims' families of any hope to see justice done. Next time on Long Shadow, hear about the place that Mohammed al-Qahtani, 15 of the 19 hijackers on September 11th, and Osama bin Laden all call home. The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Maybe you've even heard this vague term on the news a few times. The Saudi connection.
As we mentioned, Gene, the Saudi connection to this AMI story.
There are one of America's most sensitive secrets is out. Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 attack.
However, we're getting an inside look at the FBI's investigation into possible ties between Saudi Arabia and 9/11.
So what is the Saudi connection to 9/11? Find out next time on Long Shadow. Long Shadow is a production from Goat Rodeo and Long Lead. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go ahead and rate the show and leave us a review. It helps spread the word. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. John Patrick Pullen is the show's executive producer. The episode was written by me and Max. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support from Dan Eisner, Diana Albasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Production assistance on this episode from Isabel Kirby McGowan. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Longlead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski. And a thanks to ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, and the 9/11 Memorial and Museum for some of the archival audio you hear on the show.